Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me? Like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are like interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the ballroom at the Assembly Rooms. Please welcome a man who has done this far too many times. It's Richard Herring. Hello, my finest friends. Hello, welcome. Welcome to the show. Welcome to episode 400 of this podcast. If you include the Edinburgh ones, it's episode 500. So that's even better, isn't it? And if you include all the ones that we just didn't give numbers to, it's about 526. Numbers are meaningless. It's too many. Welcome to Richard Herring's Liz Sodding Truss podcast. It's all dedicated to our next Prime Minister. I'm just saying, she's great and she's going to be a great Prime Minister. Who claimed today that the Sun is part of the left-wing media to blame. Probably to her it is. Left-wing media to blame for Boris Johnson being sacked. Yeah, fair enough. I was talking to the people who used to come here when it was Richard Herring's Edinburgh Fringe podcast, and they still call it Rehef. So there we go. It's going to be... There we go. So I told you. There are other people call it Rehalastapa. There we go. We're off. Slightly worried about the beautiful sunshine outside. It's gone on for a very long time. If there are any climate change deniers out there, just come to Edinburgh for the last 35 years and then see what you think of this year's. I've never experienced anything like this in Edinburgh and I'm absolutely terrified. The alternate to our Prime Minister, who won't be Prime Minister, Richie Sunak, I like to call him, he's come out against drugs. He says he's never tried drugs, but drugs are horrific, and he'll be incredibly tough on anyone who does drugs. Will that include the people he's friends with? Will that include his friends? I don't know. We'll see. Absolutely. And, you know, it's,
The problem with these politicians is it's just, they're unsatirizable now, but also just it's gone so far. It's just this sort of Trumpian bullshit that they're just, you can just state the obvious. It doesn't matter. Nothing's going to change. But luckily, the world will be destroyed by climate change. So we should be fine. Anyway, look, thanks for coming. I don't want to faff around too long because I'm absolutely so excited about today's guest. I mean, tomorrow we've got Ed Gamble. There's got to be downs as well as ups. They can't all be golden, so you've chosen the right day to come. Bad luck to anyone who bought a ticket for tomorrow. My guest today is probably best known for her appearance as gallery owner in Werewolf Bitches from Outer Space. That's why we're all here. Will you please welcome Janine Garofalo, ladies and gentlemen? I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Come in, come on in. Thank you. Sit down and pick up a microphone. And it's Janine Garofalo. It's Janine Garofalo. I'm absolutely unbelievable. Hello.
Hello. I forgot about where.
Did you?
That's real. That's a film by a woman named Reverend Jen.
Okay.
Who is wears elf ears in life all the time. That's
okay.
What she's best known for.
Was it any good?
I have no idea. It might be. I have no wish to see myself in anything. But
okay.
You know what? She's great. So. Perhaps
good.
It is. I don't know.
All right. Terrific. Well, we'll move on to other topics. I saw you. You're up in Edinburgh. Absolutely fantastic to see you here. I'm a massive fan. And my wife and our friends came to see you, I think on maybe day two of The Fringe. To your show, Pardon My Tangent.
Yeah.
It was very hot in there.
Yeah, there is an air conditioner now, although it's theoretically there. It's very, very hot in the room. And I always say to the audience, I've been saying it so far, I understand how difficult this is. It's very hot. And it's hard as an audience to sit in the heat and listen to someone who is incapable of getting to a point succinctly and with clarity, which is me, would be me. And I feel like it needs to be addressed because it's yeah. Very, very warm in there.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't a lot of that. I did a venue one year where it was so hot, the sweat was coming over my eyebrows into my eyes. Which
yes,
was,
I do. I do sweat a great deal
yeah.
on stage, which is it's supposed to be good for your skin. So that's the upside.
It's a terrific, terrific show. I really enjoyed it. It feels like it's going to be different every time one goes to see it.
I don't know how true that is. It's slightly different. And that's not like, aren't I cool? I like to let it breathe. There is supposed to be much more structure than there is, but as I already told you, and I will show them, this has changed everything. Look at this unsolicited dreadlock. Look at that flap of knot that has it consumes me, and I can't stop talking about it. So that is where the show, unfortunately, usually starts, by addressing the elephant in my hair, and then it goes. From there, and I always have notes that I bring in, but different things happen daily
yeah.
that maybe I would like to discuss, and I would like to put that in. It's not invalid to have a very rehearsed show. I'm not criticizing that. It's just unfortunately not been my strong suit. I started doing stand-up in 1985. I will figure it out. I'll crack the code. I'll figure it out. I just need more time. As you can see now, I'm answering your question far too long.
It's good. No, you take as much time as you want. That's okay.
No, don't say that. I'm actually going to stop talking now. But I just wanted it to not... It's not supposed to be so different every night. But I do like the fact that each show is different from.
Yes. Well, I think that's what's great.
Show.
You know, in our one, you sort of got a story and then realized the time was up and we got half a story. And then
that's where I'm supposed to be starting. That
yeah.
happened every night.
Like
the kickoff thing that I say, what's hopefully going to start with, always I remember it. Like I check my watch and I'm like, oh no. And then I'll start with this thing that would have taken much longer to say. And then I'm like, I have to. And it's such a very unsatisfying end. So if anyone goes, I warn you in advance, it may be unsatisfying to you that I do not ever probably finish anything I start saying.
No, I like it. I was saying to you backstage, but it feels like you're sort of on a high wire and you're jumping in the air and we're seeing what's going to happen. But
you're giving me far too much credit. I said that to you backstage too. I in no way... And that has happened. This is probably my fourth or fifth Edinburgh, and I have somehow benefited unintentionally by that very thing. People are like, "That's so interesting the way you do that." I want you to know. it is not like, oh, wow, I'm just spitballing free for. It's not that. It's that I can't frequently remember what I meant to start telling you. And it is oddly, for the most part, I'm sure there's plenty of people who can't stand it. But those that have said nice things have said, like, that's so interesting the way you do that. And I try and tell them that, please don't, I can't take a compliment I don't deserve. It's not that.
it doesn't matter if you mean to do it. It doesn't matter if it is absolutely fascinating. It's sort of chaotic, but there is a mm-hmm. there is a form to it. And it's
hopefully. And there is things that I know I want to say, and luckily some of them come up. And there is two stools with notes all over. I have a bag, a tote bag full of notes that I have brought from JFK Airport from New York for some reason. Never looked at it yet. Never even opened the bag. And then there's one Ziploc bag that I take out.
Yes.
And it's in Ziploc bags for in case it rains. And that I can see more readily. So usually there's stuff like, oh, that.
Yeah. Well, but there's plenty of content. I love the story about you.
That's a good title. Plenty of content.
Oh, you can have it.
Thank you.
You can have it. I love the story about you being mistaken for a homeless person.
That is true, and that's not a criticism of the homeless.
No.
And I'm not doing bits for you. He brought it up organically. Three times over the last 8 or so years, I've been mistaken for someone who is, shall we say, between jobs and between homes. And, oh, there you are. I know you. And there's reasons for it. And now my physical appearance is not quite up to snuff. And sometimes my hair is gray to here. And sometimes there's more unsolicited dreadlocks. And my clothes are very wrinkly all the time. And I sweat a great deal. And sometimes when I'm by garbage, and I've also picked up other litter, that those that are ill-mannered and not putting in. So I'm picking up garbage and also trying to throw my garbage away, and it has very nice, well-meaning people have asked if I need help or I'm okay, stuff like that. And I understand why they're doing it, but it's three times, Baltimore, Seattle, and Portland.
Right.
It's happened.
Well, it spoke to me because I've been mistaken for a homeless person by a homeless
with
person,
like
which
that.
I think is...
Well, in Baltimore, that's...
Was it?
That,
yeah.
Because it's different context. In Baltimore, it was a fellow homeless person who thought I was... in their covenant, in their group, and said, that bicycle you were asking about, I found it. That happened in Baltimore. Yeah. But I can't believe anyone, with hair like that. Look
I
at the
I used
shine.
To have a maybe
Look
slightly more...
Look at the
more,
thickness of his hair. Look at the perfect shade of gray.
I think it was slightly more straggly, and I used to wear jeans that I'd sort of just stamped the ends on, and they would trail on the floor.
And also, I cut my pants, because I'm 5 foot one, so my pants are cut, and there's frequently just strings hanging.
Yeah.
So that might add to that.
But I think there's some brotherhood or camaraderie between... That sort of stuff. I'm always slightly fascinated by the way that stand-up comedy and mental illness often go hand in hand, because there's some mental illness in the person doing the stand-up comedy. But it's sort of about, you know, playing around with the rules of society and stepping out of society. So maybe
I never thought of it that way. Yeah. That's not how it seems. That's I don't think what's happening.
No.
I think it is a visual. Yeah. It's visual, and I fully understand why they think that.
And, you know, I find
this is one of my nicer outfits. I'm sorry to tell you that, but this is kind of one of my nicer outfits. I've got technical pants. They've been Fabriced.
Look, let's talk a bit about... I loved you calling your show sort of freelance filibustering. I think that is...
It's not that. That's what I'm saying, what my calling is.
Yeah.
which I discovered a couple years ago that... Do you have filibusters here in your political system?
We know what it is. It's not quite as big a deal.
It's when somebody on the floor of the Senate or whatever tries to stop a bill from passing by just talking and running out the clock. And it's a filibuster. Yeah. That's what I think I'd be great at.
Yeah.
I really do feel that's my forte, because stand-up comedy really isn't. And I'm glad people like it when they like it, but I really think that if there was a need for freelance...
Well, isn't
filibustering,
it,
I'd be great.
In a way, there is, and you don't have one. Doing a podcast is just freelance.
Yeah, I don't have a.
You don't have a podcast,
right? and I always say that it's not a civic obligation. Everyone has a podcast. I feel there's enough. There's enough. And you get to be a guest on podcasts so much.
Yeah.
Now, if I had something that I felt to bring to the table, like, you know what, this needs to be heard. This podcast needs to happen. I would do it. But failing that, I don't feel comfortable doing a podcast because I don't feel I have anything to add to the forum.
Don't let that worry you. Don't let
it hasn't stopped a lot of other people. But the thing is I think people feel the need to have it, to have one. And some are very wonderful and quite, very interesting. And that's fine. But I don't... It's like with all the social media and stuff, and I know it's generational a bit. I'm not comfortable with... I don't have social media platforms or anything like that. But younger people couldn't possibly imagine a world where they didn't. And also, it's like a full-time job for a lot of businesses, including stand-up comedy. It is a necessity to do it, but I'm not comfortable with it. You will lose audience members if you don't do it. But I don't like it. No. I don't want to do it.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I think you would be amazing at it, and I completely understand. And you do talk about this in the show as well, but I understand your reasons for not doing it. Although you did like you were part of a radio.
I worked at Air America Radio in the Bush era. Rachel Maddow worked there. Al Franken, Mark Maron, Chuck D from Public Enemy, and it was a way to bring uncensored news out at a very ridiculous. I mean, there's lots of ridiculous times in American history. But a really post 9/11 George W. Bush, painful. Yeah. And so a group of people got together to start this radio station. I didn't start it, but I asked to be part of it because I was like, I feel like that's one of the only interesting things I've ever done. Like that is, I don't have a lot to recommend me. But I feel like that one era when I was doing that, I feel like this feels like it is at least contributing something in some way or trying to. And then, of course, it went out of business. The fundraisers, the first fundraisers absconded with the money.
Really?
And then secretly some of the people that worked there put money in. And then another group of us didn't take salaries. And even with that, I believe it was destroyed from the inside. I feel like the worst possible people to take control of it. I think they were secretly Republican or something. And that's not like tinfoil hat stuff. Because it's a blood sport for them. Yeah. And they get great joy from being contemptuous and destroying things.
Yeah.
And I feel like something weird. And then the building exploded. Okay. That's true. The boiler in the basement exploded. Coincidude? I don't think so. Might have been a coincidence.
But that's a sort of podcast before podcasting, possibly. And with,
well, Mark Maron started with Sam Cedar. Yeah. Sam Cedar, who still has a podcast called The Majority Report. But Mark Maron and Sam Cedar started the foundations of WTF. Then Mark Maron went on to do that. And he was like right place, zeitgeisty, if that's right. He's one of the forerunners of people. It just took off. It just touched a chord culturally.
Yeah.
I don't know if it resonated as much here. I'm not sure.
Look how many people are here. I'm one of them. I'm one of the successful ones here, and this is as good as it gets.
This is a lot of people for 1 o'clock.
It's not too bad.
It's early. I feel because when I have to get up to be somewhere, I don't know what I do. But when people are like, you want to meet for lunch? Yeah, give me 5.5 hours. I don't know what it is that I'm doing, and to look like this, you know what I mean? Like I don't know what I'm doing. Like I got to read that. I think I don't know what I'm doing. But I had to get up at 8 o'clock. That's true. At 8 a.m. this morning with a wake up call because I can't be late. And then as it happened, I did have some time to kill. So I went to Fat Face across the street. I feel you should say it like that clothing store, Fat Face. Sounds like you're being insulted when you walk in, but I was actually early.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, I'm glad you're here.
Do you see why I can't have a podcast?
Yeah,
it's horrible. Horrible listening to me.
It hasn't stopped me. It hasn't stopped me podcasting. Look, I don't think you get the. I mean, I think you get a lot of credit. I don't think you get the credit you deserve. I think you, having read up on your early stand-up, and the thing I became aware of you from my own personal point of view was the Larry Sanders Show, which mm-hmm. I still consider to be the greatest.
That was my first acting job. I came late to acting. I started stand-up at 19, but I didn't start acting until I was 27, which I think is considered late. And it was because of Gary Shandling, Gary Shandling, who I knew from stand-up. And the other job I had that same year was the Ben Stiller Show. And Ben I met from stand-up. It was just this fortuitous, unbelievably lucky that those two had some faith in me and cast me in their shows. But the Gary Shandling Show is one of the best jobs I ever had. I didn't understand it's not like that in other acting things where somebody allows you to try this or try that. It was so enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, he did several fantastic shows, was a fantastic stand-up, mm-hmm. and we lost him much too early as well. But there was obviously something special about that. That show just was sort of mind-blowing.
It was very groundbreaking. Yeah. Now, if you come to it now, it'll look quite dated, or it'll seem like, well, what's so groundbreaking about that? But many other shows have utilized some of the techniques. And the camera person, Peter Smokler, was on rollerblades and pulled through the sets. There was a standing set, and you didn't have to wait for lighting. It was, and either you were in frame or out of frame, you know, that kind of thing. There was a lot of freedom, and he was being pulled around, similar to a handheld, but also it just had a look of like, I guess the way the office looks, things like that.
Yeah.
There's a visual look to it, but there's some younger people that just will discover it now and think it doesn't have the same effect on them.
Sure.
That's not a criticism of the young at all.
I watched it. We bought the box set maybe 4 or 5 years ago and watched the whole thing again. Because I don't think I'd ever seen it in order. The BBC treated it very shoddily, and Seinfeld as well, which we were also in, that they put those shows out at 11 o'clock at night, and some weeks they wouldn't bother putting them out. And so I wanted to watch the whole thing from start to finish, which we did very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's... I mean, all the characters, there's in that show, there are, you know, characters that could all have their own sitcom. Paula, that you played, was a fantastic
character.
Well,
it's also based on a real person, the character that I played. A lot of it is based on behind the scenes at the Letterman show.
Right.
There was two of the head writers had worked at Late Night with David Letterman.
Yeah.
And so some of the things that would happen backstage and things like that. So my character was based on a real person. Unfortunately, I didn't understand about typecasting. I was quite ignorant, and I got asked to play a similar type of character all the time, and I was just like, this is so great. People want to hire me. And then on cut to 10 years later, it's like, no, we've seen it, one trick pony. It's so painful because I'm not like Heather Mooney and Romy and Michelle or any of those things. I'm not mean, and yet I always get asked to play very mean people, and it really limits you. And then when you do things that are more versatile, it tends to be low budget stuff that no one ever sees, things of that nature. But it's very difficult when you do get typecast. I'm not saying anybody owes me anything, but sometimes it even bars you from the opportunity to try, to audition for stuff like that.
I mean, but it's the problem if you're it's one of your first major roles, but obviously like straight out there, bang into this award-winning
Paula
show.
Paula was the first, like, and, yeah. no, and no, like and known.
So, you know, but it was such a great character. And as much as I liked Mary Lynn, who took over, it was...
Mary Lynn Rice Cup, yes.
It was a shame that you weren't there when you left.
Yeah, I made a big mistake. I went to Saturday Night Live. Boo! Yeah. I should have never... I mean, it's not like that. I mean, it has its ups and downs. It can be great, and it can have dips. I happened to be there at a time when it was not... the comedy was not to my taste.
No.
And I was unable to bring anything to the table. I just failed miserably there. And I had been warned by Bob Odenkirk, who was also on Larry Sanders' Show at the time, and he had said, don't go. You're not going to like it. You're not going to like SNL, but you have to. It's like, it's just one of those things in the States. It seems like if you have to do it.
Yeah.
And I just failed. Now, luckily, so few people would even know I was on it. I was there for about, it's like my parking meter ran out and I was gone. And it's just a real miserable failure on my part. Plus, I had a drink. We were talking about that backstage. I am the first to say uncle. I'm not a real fighter when it comes, if it seems like people are not pleased with me, I'm like, okay, I'll just go. And I regret that. And I just was drunk 90% of the time.
Right.
Which I'm not proud of at not.
It seems that you're very unlikely. There's an amazing, I think it's in the New Yorker, there's an amazing article from The Time about Saturday Night Live being in the doldrums, and someone comes and there's a very long article.
That was one of the things that was not helpful at all.
Right.
Now, I in no way saw myself and some of the others that were hired that year, none of us saw ourselves as saviors in any way. Unfortunately, no. Journalists are not your friend frequently. And they made it seem like we were saying, we're coming here to save this. Oh boy, that doesn't endear you to your coworkers. And also there at the time, there was some people who worked there that loved to foment discord. So they put copies of that article on the writer's room table for all to see with highlighter over lines that implied that we felt we were going to come save. So right from the start, it was like,
But it also,
terrible.
It does feel like you were in the right. I mean, the thing that we watch Saturday Night Live all the time, which isn't something that many people in the UK do. So the last few series we've watched. And the thing that massively annoys me about it is that they never learn their lines. And you tried to learn your lines.
It's a strange thing. Some do. Some do know their lines. You are encouraged to read the cue cards. I don't know why. Now, there is times where they change it and you don't even know. And it's at the last minute. That really wasn't the case when I was there. Now, like I said, it's different all the time. And sometimes the show is very, very good. And sometimes less so. And that's the nature of a show that's been on for 45 years, right? At that particular time, you would actually get in trouble if you didn't look at the cue cards. It was the strangest thing. And I would try and... Because even drunk, I can learn... I knew my lines. And I always felt like it's better to be staring at the person you're speaking to, but the cameras are locked in a certain way that you see people looking not at each other. Now, I do
it's
understand
incredibly distracting,
when some people have so much to do.
Yeah.
There's some people, and the lines are changed. But like I said, that wasn't the case for me, and it really also made me feel like this isn't right for me. I don't feel this is a good fit.
I just think you're a very you're a difficult person to bottle, I think, right? And I think you were cool and you are cool, but from those shows and from your stand-up, they wanted to bottle you and put you into certain things and use what was fantastic about you. And I think it was some of those more mainstream things, and it was hard for you to, because that's not how you operate.
It's hard for everybody on the show. They also have too many cast members. That's a problem they've had for many years, in my opinion. They started off originally in 75 with 8 cast members who also wrote. That's really what it should be, 10 max.
Yeah.
And as you know, if you watch the opening credits, it goes on and on and on and on, or like an episode of Rick and Morty. If you watch that, they're like, a piece of toast, a cup. Like, it just goes on and on. Yeah. I guess. But when you have so many people and you have some people that still like to divide, to conquer, it can be quite painful. And so many people just sit on the bench all the time, even though they're very, very good. Because how can you service 17, 18?
Yeah.
It just makes no sense to hire that way. I think it's a bad business model. I think anyone who's worked there would agree with that.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure why they do that, because keeping things lean is everybody has much more investment. They get much more time to show what they can do.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's ever going to change now that new paradigm has been established, sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, where there's endless cast members and then you don't see them. And then sometimes then they're not there anymore and they go on to do great. And you can see like, boy, that person was so talented. How did they not thrive? But you have to have the combination of work ethic, luck. Lauren likes you and you are a person that, like I said, like with Molly and with Amy as just some examples, they just make it work, and they can get. They don't get bogged down in personal rivalries. They don't gossip. They don't get drunk. They just and they thrive.
Sure. Well, let's move on from Saturday Night Live, but because I think there's in this there's an article more recently which revealed that.
Something I got to hurt my feelings. Don't tell.
No, no, it's not. It's good. I mean, it's funny that you introduced. Did you introduce David Cross to Bob Odenkirk?
I did introduce
it. That's a pretty amazing.
I knew David Cross. I met David Cross when I was in college. He was at Emerson College and I was at Providence College, and we were both doing open mics in Boston. And then I had moved to Los Angeles. I had met Bob Odenkirk prior to moving to Los Angeles, but David then came out to Los Angeles to start writing for the Ben Stiller Show, and Bob Odenkirk used to play basketball on Sundays. And I lived right near him. I walked David over, who wanted to play basketball. Bob didn't even get up from the couch. He looked through the screen door, and I said, Bob, this is my friend David. He wants to play basketball. And Bob's eating a sandwich. He goes, no, thanks. And he just goes back to watch. That's true.
Yeah.
And Bob used to be, like, raised by wolves. I don't know why. He didn't mean to, but it was, and now he's so nice. You know, he's got children, all that kind of stuff. He's just the best. But it took till the Montreal Comedy Festival where they were forced to sleep in the same room because I was sharing a room, I think, with either Bob or David, but these two young girls had hitchhiked to come see my show, and they were going to hitchhike back home. And I was like, no, you're not. They were 16. It's like, you're going to sleep on my floor. I'm not allowing Genevieve, I remember, was one of them. This is in, like, 1993. And I was like, I cannot allow teenage girls to go hitchhiking home. So they slept on my floor, so it was either Bob or David had to go. And Bob and David slept in the same room and stayed up all night giggling like schoolgirls and were best friends from then on. Wow. So it took a little bit of time for Bob to see the wonder of Dave Cross. And then they went on to do Mr. Show, among other things. I mean, really, really seminal comedy series.
Bob said of you that he said something very nice about you. I wrote it down, I thought, but I don't know if I had it. You basically were the spark that sort of set... Janine was the spark of the Big Bang for that whole...
That's not true. He's being too kind. What he's talking about is like the spark of... I have been miscredited in some places of like starting alternative, which I think means something slightly different than here.
Sure.
And I think you had what was called alternative comedy earlier than we did. Now, alternative comedy, I take to mean, at least in the 80s and 90s when it was happening, a place, you're doing stand-up in an alternative to a comedy club proper. You're doing it in a space that isn't a comedy club, like a chain comedy club or something.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've been miscredited with, like, it had been going on, and also people misunderstanding my style of stand-up. It's not deliberately obtuse. You know what I mean? Like, alternative. It was that I've never been a strong joke writer. I'm just not. And so I wind up rambling, much like now. And so it's nice that he says that. It's just not true.
But you allude to this in your show, though, as well. It's interesting that all the guys from that time, and all the people you've mentioned pretty much, Bob and David and Adam Sandler and all the SNL guys, are all still kind of Hollywood figures.
And, oh, my God. Yeah, and Bob just got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Yeah. Bob Odenkirk is like in the stratosphere, but famous, as is Adam. But David's done very, very well. And there's plenty of women, too. It's just we haven't touched upon it. There's plenty of fantastic... if you were about to say there wasn't diversity.
Well,
there was
I'm not saying there's not diversity. I'm just saying that, you know, you were talking in the show about Top Gun, Maverick, and how that it's all the men from the original film, none of the women.
Oh, it's just one thing. It has to do with a text about Top Gun, Maverick. and Kelly McGillis not being allowed to be in it because she's so old. But because, you know, Tom Cruise is... That wasn't a statement on gender or anything.
Okay.
It was just I didn't even see Top Gun Maverick. I just know that she's not in it.
Okay.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
But it feels, you know, it sort of feels to me you were such a big part of that. And then, you know, and I know you, I mean, there's endless stuff we can go through. And you've been in, you know, you've been in so many, even I'd forgotten you were in The Sopranos and someone put
just
me.
Just a couple episodes.
Yeah, but it was, it's great.
It was a thrill. Great. It was a thrill to be part of
and
that.
And you're
sure.
In West Wing. And I think you're in Larry Sanders, which is the greatest TV show of all time. You're in BoJack Horseman. So you're still getting.
Me
still,
and everybody else, like the list of people who've been in voice on. But also with Mary Lynn, I got to be on 24 with her.
Yeah.
And I've known her for years as a stand-up. She's a great stand-up. But it was, and 24, the year that I was on, there was a writer's strike for months and months. And Mary Lynn, unbeknownst to her, got pregnant. And then by the time we came back from the writer's strike, she was fully pregnant, but it's supposed to be one day, 24 hours on the show 24. So if you ever have seen that season, she's behind a box, all of a sudden behind a box. And she luckily is one of those people that gets pregnant and it's just like a basketball, like you can't really tell.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're doing stand-up on tour almost until her ninth month. She didn't even know she was pregnant until like month five. That's the way to do it if you're going to do it. Don't even know. Not that I've ever been pregnant, but I presume it's unpleasant. And so she only had like 4 months. She had no like problems with it, and she didn't gain any weight except for right here. But she was clearly not looking the same as the second before the writer's strike, and then they pick up the show, right? And she's pregnant. So then they had my character throw her in jail for some, like my character Janice Gold fabricated some evidence against Chloe of being a mole or something. So she had to go to prison because she was going to have a baby in 24 hours on the show 24.
How'd they get into prison so quickly?
And then they would shoot her on, they had to rewrite everything on CCTV as if she's in her cell. And she was always in the corner like this so that you can't see that she's pregnant.
But you know, I mean, it does feel like you being in something is a mark of quality. It does.
Oh no, it's usually the kiss of death. Shows usually get canceled. That was like the last season of 24. Okay. I was on the last season of West Wing.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I feel like it's not good for the show at all. Things tend to get canceled. And Billions. I was on Billions until unfortunately there was an issue with Damian Lewis, and so that character had to be stopped. And I loved being on Billions. And so it seems like having me in the cast is not helpful to the show. Now, having said that, I would love to work. I'm not going to say that. Don't have me. But there are some jobs that are just so much fun. You really wish they could go on and on.
I mean, you've done so much acting. But
in the last season of Younger. I was on a show called Younger, and it got canceled.
Yeah, but, you know, hopefully we'll do more of these after this. We'll see. we'll see what happens. I'll talk about this. I was going to say something else, but you heard you in another podcast saying that you don't hustle, that you feel like you don't.
I'm not, like I said, in life, and again, I'm not proud of this. I don't get a lot done in it. I'm not a real go-getter. I got super lucky in the 90s with acting. Super lucky. I was standing in the right place at the right time, and I knew two people that were quite helpful. And then I was lucky from there for a good run of the 90s. Then, boom, over. Yeah. And it's almost like I'm paying dues. And then it's not like that now. So now you got to do stuff and hustle. And that's why you may have thought I was dead. Because for the last 22 years, and so many people that I know really well in the States will say, why did you quit acting and quit doing stand-up? I didn't. I didn't, and sometimes I feel so stupid about that. I'll say, I've been volunteering at an animal shelter. Like, I'll pretend that I've been doing something very good. I haven't quit. I know why it seems like I have, but it's hard work to stay, to be protected by the umbrella of continued career success.
Of course.
You have to be a super hard worker, make all the right choices, and also be talented. But there's some people who stay. That's 0.5% of SAG-AFTRA. 0.5% of SAG-AFTRA. Like, let's say, for example, Brad Pitt or something. You've known them your whole life. You know what I mean? Jennifer Aniston, your whole life. That takes a huge amount of not minding being in the public eye all the time, doing press, doing photo, like, and I think about it, it's like, you've got kids and stuff. Do you not want to see them? I feel like because if these people are not working on something, they're preparing for something, or they're in the gym, or they're being seen socially.
Yeah.
So it's, but I think the dream is to get to a point where you don't have to do any of the quotidian things in life except your work or go to the gym. Because that seems to be necessary too, and I'm not doing that. And do you know what I'm saying? Like you achieve a level of success where your assistants have assistants. Now I certainly don't need an assistant, but I'm saying like what a dream. They will do all the things in life that you do, like cleaning your bathroom, all that stuff. You don't have to do anything but your work. Like that to me is necessary, But that takes so much. Do you not understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's just not in me.
Yeah.
To do that, I've never been a person that's like seize the day.
No.
I live every day like it's my first. is what I'm saying.
And do you see? You know, you have done so much acting, and but it feels to me that at heart you're a stand-up comedian.
Oh, I'm definitely. That is my passion.
Yeah.
And luckily. I control that. So I don't know how actors who don't have the sustained, it's very difficult. You don't control that. You can't force people it's got to be very difficult. Whereas if you also have another outlet and stand up being something I enjoy a great deal, I've never lost interest in it. It's the only thing in my whole life I've not lost interest in. I've been just as interested in doing it from when I started to now. And that's very unusual for me.
Yep.
And I'm so glad, because you can always do it. Doesn't mean lots of people can see you, but you can always do stand-up somehow.
Yeah.
You can't always act in a way to live, to make enough money to live comfortably, especially if you have children and stuff, which I don't. Now, that also gives me a freedom. If I had children, I would have to hustle. You know what I mean? Because it's in service of the quality of their lives. And luckily, I don't have any that I am aware of. That I, you know what I mean? But it allows you a freedom to...
Sure.
And also, I don't buy a lot of things. Yeah. I live well within my means. And that's another problem people get into, right? They keep having to work or take jobs. And this is in any area of your life. To cover a mortgage, to cover your nut, to cover all the bills. And now, like, with the recession that's going on... Mm-hmm. It is, just to put gas in your car, all of these things cause people's lives, where a great many of people do things they may not truly enjoy doing.
Of course.
And so when people say phrases like, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. Well, guess what? 90% of people don't get to do that.
Yeah.
It's actually a thing to say, it's verbal dust to me. Because so many people, you have to live, you have to take care of your family, you have to keep a roof over your head. And very many people don't get to do what they love. That's just not the way life works out a lot of times.
And it seems to me within the stand-up, what I enjoy about it, and maybe this is a way you keep getting the audience you get, but it's you don't shy away from intellectual subjects and intelligent stuff. You don't sort of pander to your audience. There's a lot of stuff about yourself, but I saw you doing... a routine about whether, or just discussing whether Julius Caesar was a reformer or a dictator.
That's true. That is something.
Listen, not many stand-ups get into that.
Well, there's a it fits into because I was forced, I was forced to get a physical on the Ides of March, which allowed me to bring up Julius Caesar which I have for years felt, in all sincerity, it's not a routine per se, but I guess it is if I'm doing it. I think he was a reformer, not a dictator. So I think it was treason, not tyrannicide, and I love being able to say that. The word tyrannicide, so many people are like, ooh, good word. And, because it is my belief you don't get assassinated for being authoritarian or keeping up the status quo. You get assassinated when you're trying to change things. And I don't have evidence to support this, but I believe, most of us get our information about Julius Caesar from Shakespeare, like many, many things. But if you read about Rome and you read about ancient Rome and you read about the various leaders of Rome, he historically did try and lower taxes, give land to people that were considered plebs, or try and get people in the Senate that were working class, things of that nature. That's why he was assassinated. Because when in history has somebody been assassinated for being an asshole? Pardon me, I don't like that kind of talk. But do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. It doesn't tend to be that way.
They tried to get Hitler a few times. I think that was mainly for him being an asshole.
But they didn't get him, did they? He killed himself. That's what I'm saying.
That's their incompetence.
He had a good run there. Like, and I don't mean boo, cancel. I didn't mean that, good run. I canceled myself. I just canceled myself, so don't. He had a run.
He did have a run.
He achieved... I don't want to say achieved a lot. He I'm not anti-Semitic. Listen to me. He was around a while. I don't know what else to say. Before.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah. But no, I think you're right. It's just, what I'm interested in is that you will put that stuff into your stand-up set and that you're not worried about that, and you're not talking down to your audience or worrying about whether...
Well, there's no reason to talk down to them. No. Presumably, you know, I am
you have
not
to talk down to these ones, that's what I'm going to say. But that's...
You can only speak to people, excuse me, only speak to people the way you speak to people. And I'm not a particularly intelligent person. I'm intellectually curious, I guess, which is a plus, but I'm not... I was a terrible student, and I... there's a whole lot I don't know, and I can't do math, can't follow simple directions. I'm a poor orienteer. as I said, I don't have a lot to recommend me, but I can only speak the way I speak, and there's no reason to, why would, you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? And I do worry that it's boring sometimes, but I certainly don't think I'm in any danger of being smarter than anyone else in the room at all. Well, I don't know. I have no idea where you're coming from. But you're here, right? You're here to see him. And it's early. I'm presuming that you are of normal intelligence, if not above average.
They're pretty smart. But I think most comedians are, you know, it's not necessarily about doing well at school. Most comedians, I think you've got to have a certain level of intelligence.
Well, no, there's academic intelligence, yeah. And there's emotional intelligence, yeah. And there's intellectual maturity, all of that.
But it's also about knowing, you know, you've got to know a lot of stuff as a comedian, I think, to really work, because you've got to be able to, you know, if you're talking about something and something comes up, you've got to know enough to be able to carry on.
Right. If that's your choice to talk about certain things, hopefully one would know what they're talking about, but again, that hasn't stopped others in any area of life, because lots of people speak, everybody has an opinion, but there's some comedians over the years I have noticed that will change their demeanor, or the way they present themselves is very different on stage and off stage. If you speak to them backstage, it's quite, they seem to they become less articulate, or I can't explain it. It's not a lot, but I've noticed that there are some that, or they fake a real high energy thing. They don't feel comfortable not attacking the stage, like, you know, high energy. And I feel like you can only start where you are. I do feel that the audience can sense inauthenticity.
Yeah.
And me as a viewer, I do like it when I feel somebody's being authentic, whether they are or are not, I don't know. But if they, if it seems like there's an authenticity, I like that. I don't know how you feel about it, but if you sense a comedian's like, I don't believe what they're saying. I don't think that's true. Like, there's sometimes where, and when I was used to be drunk all the time, this is where I would get in trouble. I'd be like, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. No, it didn't. Which I'm not proud of, but there would be sometimes, not in the audience, but back, I would be backstage and there'd be a comic on stage and I'm like, that didn't happen. No, it didn't. Or, boy, you did a lot today. Because sometimes it'll be like, this happened today, or this. Why are you manufacturing content? Life is so much, in the same way science is so much more interesting than religion. It answers the big question. You know, it can.
Yeah.
And just because we can't explain something doesn't mean it's paranormal or supernatural. And I know what can be emotionally comforting to go that way, but in the same way that I find that scientific inquiry is more interesting than paranormal or yeah. or supernatural. I think that a comedian being authentic is more interesting than faking a demeanor or manufacturing content.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of comedians make that mistake and start off
early,
trying to
especially,
be, yeah,
for
trying,
sure.
trying to be
something
they're not.
Totally valid. You know,
and it's harder to become the thing you really. That you,
it took
that you
me
really
10
are.
Years.
Yeah.
10 years to say, oh, that's I'm being me. And it took me almost that long to stop doing shots before I went on because I was physically shaking and I didn't want people to see me shaking. Now, I probably could have quit that sooner, but I became addicted to that pattern. I'm addicted to my habits. Same with my eyebrows. I think that's why it takes me 5.5 hours to get out of the house. I'll tell you the truth. Q-tip, Q-tip, Q-tip. They're not level. But I get addicted to patterns like a lot of people. And I was like, I have to do a shot. I have to. And then I didn't have time once. And I realized, oh, I don't have to.
Yeah.
I was about 8 years in. 10 years in, I remember thinking, I'm being me. I'm finally being me. Regrettably, there is some footage. Now, luckily, when I started doing stand-up there, it wasn't a surveillance society. Luckily. Because, but the few things that exist earlier on, I'm so ashamed of because I was trying to be too cool for school because I was insecure. And I would just stand there and even lower the register of my voice. It was already pretty deep, like barely talking. And I'm like, I hate that. I hate that I did that. It embarrasses me so much. But luckily, you have no idea what I'm talking about. And you haven't seen it, but there is some footage that exists.
I saw a little bit of earlier.
Oh,
but it's interesting.
I hate that because it's not me. It's not me.
No, well, it's interesting. I think like when I came to see you this, you know, this festival, I was thinking, you know what? I was ready to be intimidated and scared of you because I'm gonna think, you know, I'm gonna interview you, I was thinking I'm ready to be, you know, for Paula to turn up or whatever, all that slightly sarky.
But why?
I don't know, because that's why you even,
but the thing is what's so strange about it, A, that happened in 1992. Sure. But B, the and others have said that to me. I'm not mad at you.
No.
I'm saying
you're not like that.
But do they in other areas do people say, oh, so-and-so who played an assassin. I was expecting to be assassin. You know, I mean, I don't understand that. You're asked to play a character in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not like that. But there have been people over the years that say, I was ready for you to be mean to me. Why? And also, I'm 58. That doesn't wear well. I realize I'm dressed inappropriately for my age. But the thing is it would be so... unappealing at my age to be snarky or to try and provoke for the sake of it. That's my opinion. I think it doesn't wear well as one gets older. Now, when I was younger, unfortunately, and a lot of it had to do with alcohol, I was not as well-mannered as I should have been, and I might have deliberately, if there was a person who perhaps their stand-up was not to my taste, I might have been deliberately provocative, which I'm ashamed of. When people say that to me, especially now, after all this time, that you would say you were ready to be, why would Paula come to be interviewed?
I mean, it's partly due to, you know, but it's partly due to the, you know, having seen you for so long and being, you know, I worry when I, you know, I don't often have people I respect on here, to be honest. So it's when you meet someone that you have respect for and when you've, you know, I know how much you've done, however modest you are and however much you say it's luck and whatever. It's not true.
It is true.
And, you know, so it's intimidating. There's an intimidation there and I was ready to, you know, you don't know how someone's going to turn out. And I think especially when someone's been as ingrained in like, Hollywood and movies and stuff like that, that changes.
But again, not for
changes.
The last 22 years. That we're going, I mean, way back.
Yeah.
I have been unfamous for far longer than I was ever famous. Now, in the States, that's true. In the States, like I said, I got super lucky in the decade of the 90s.
Yeah.
And in the States, anyway, that I was known.
Yeah.
And I worked a lot. And a lot of it probably didn't transfer over here. Why would it? I wouldn't expect you to know that. And I have been unknown in a way or not working like that for about 22 years now. So that was like this aberration.
Yeah.
This lucky thing that like, wow, that happened. and then as fast as it started, it ended as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful that it happened. It would be fun for it to happen again. But I feel like, you know, it's not going to. And it took me about 12 years to make my peace with that one. Like, I'll get lucky again. you're not going to. And it's not, you know, it just, it is what it is. And the thing is that that's why I get embarrassed. Like when people say, what credits do you want me to say? Don't, because it just highlights what I'm not doing. Don't say stuff from way back, because yeah. A, depending on the age of the audience, A, they don't know that they wouldn't probably have a reference point, but B, it's like, oh boy, she's done nothing for like the last 20
but
years.
But it's not, but I think you've always been, you know, autonomous and wanting to be you, even when you're saying you're not being authentically you. It took you a while to become that. You were always doing what you wanted to do. And I think you were just, it was impossible to bottle you. And that's why I think like now the kind of films that come out now anyway, I can't imagine you being in, you know, you were lucky to be at a point where there were some reasonably decent Hollywood films.
There's plenty of good. There's always good and bad entertainment. Yeah. That's the nature of entertainment, no matter what, music, movie. In fact, I would say now more than ever, TV-wise, there's more great TV than ever and more great outlets. And they're like 90% of SAG-AFTRA. I do work in a lot of films, but these are like so low. They're truly, I'm not talking Independent Spirit Award alleged, where you see the same actors you'll see at the Oscars. They're just wearing black jeans during the day. But you'll see the same people in a gown and a tuxedo that night at the Oscars. So the Independent Spirit Awards is a misnomer at this point. But there is a whole world of independent work going on. Yeah. And also now more than ever with the device, you could shoot a movie on your phone, things like that.
Sure.
And lots of people are doing that work. Now, unfortunately, you don't have the money to make it. You certainly don't have the money to distribute it. And that it will drop late night on some streaming service or whatever. But there is work happening.
Yeah.
And like I said, 90% of the Actors Union is doing that kind of work. It isn't hugely known or whatever, but it's there, and there's no it's unfortunate though that sometimes a lot of that stuff really suffers from the lack of money that has time to make it. Sometimes you have to shoot the film in 13-14 days, which you cannot, it just can't be done. Yeah. It's really hard, and it's been like, can you bring some jeans from home for your wardrobe, stuff like that. So it's almost like you're doing a play.
Yeah.
And It's interesting, but I feel sorry for these people that have bankrupted their parents' credit cards or their own for this project that they've done. I do feel like not everybody should be directing. I know it sounds great to say it. I'm a director, but just because you want to say it doesn't mean you should do it, because there's a lot of people out there putting themselves in great debt. Because it seems like, because I'm just judging from watching them on the set, they seem to have no natural ability to direct or a vision. But they're going into terrible debt,
yeah,
probably for the rest of their lives to do this thing.
Yeah.
But it provides jobs,
sure,
which is good for the crew. And, you know, it's always, crews are the best part of any production.
Yeah.
The crew people that you work with, that's the most enjoyable part, because they're always so fun to hang around with and stuff.
Sure. And are you still enjoying? I mean, you've been doing stand up for a long time, as have I. And are you still enjoying doing the shows?
Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, I wish I didn't have a night off here.
Right.
I have a night off, and it's like no. As I was saying earlier, I enjoy it, even when it's not going. I enjoy doing it, and I've always enjoyed it, even. Well, sometimes when it's so bad, it's painful, and it confirms my worst fears about myself. That's a different issue. But it doesn't stop me from doing it. And when I can't do it sometimes, I miss it terribly.
Yeah.
I just love to do it. So, yeah, I look forward every night to doing it.
Good.
And one of the best things about Edinburgh, if you stay the whole month, you can do it almost every night. It's a joy to do it.
Yeah. And it is good to have that freedom. And what will happen next? Are you taking this?
Well, I go back to New York. I've got some stuff there, and then I've got road stuff in like Austin and Dallas and Portland and stuff like that. And I will continue to try and act if they'll have me.
Yeah.
I can't do anything about that, and I'm not. And sometimes, and I have written scripts for other people, stuff like that. I do enjoy that as an intellectual exercise. Like I do enjoy doing some ghostwriting or taking passes at other people's scripts. I enjoy that a great deal. I don't enjoy the development process, stuff like that, at all. But that I hope to do more of that, too. But I would just, you know, I'd like to just be number 14 on the call sheet of an existing show that runs like a well-oiled machine that is in walking distance to my apartment. That's the dream. That's the dream. And also my character wears scrubs, hospital scrubs, all the time. Honestly, like if I had been, I auditioned 3 times for Orange is the New Black. And I haven't been able to watch it because it hurts me. Yeah. I didn't get on. But to wear scrubs, they wear scrubs. They wear jail. Now, I see that they wear makeup now because it's successful. If it's still on, they went from being like looking like they were really in jail to now looking like they've gone to Sephora or Boots or Superdrug. Yeah. But to wear scrubs and also make it look like you're not wearing makeup. Oh, the dream. And also that I don't have to start work for whatever reason until after noon like that. And then I'm always wrapped by like 8 p.m.
Okay.
That's the job.
Apart from
that's
all those.
That's the job
things.
I'm looking for.
Okay. We'll put a call out for
and
that.
And my character's
job.
Always sitting. Always sitting. Either in a nice chair or behind a desk.
Okay.
That is truly the dream. Okay.
We can sort that out for you. I'll write you something that's work for you. But I think like me, you know, like I've heard you talk about the process of creating something, and you know the executive involvement in things seems to be the thing that
it defeats me. Yeah. That now there's like a lot of people over the years who are trying to act and stuff. You get encouraged to try and develop projects. Now I don't need to have a project for me. I would like an ensemble thing, you know, and over the years I have written with partners or written by myself. And then as soon as the meeting process starts, again, uncle, I say, I give. And I'm like, well, you can make this, but I'm not going to be a part of it. Because the executives have to justify their job. So they will give you notes, whether they really care about it or not. They have to say something. And then sometimes I'll do a test where I'll say, what did you think about the character who keeps having these horrible dreams. I'm making something up. And they'll comment on it. It's not in there. It's not in the script. And that's how I really know.
Yeah.
It is not in there. And they will comment on it. They'll say, well, I didn't think, is it necessary? I didn't think it was that. And then it's like, I know I'm going down the wrong road here.
Yeah.
But your manager or your agent will encourage you because they're in a different aspect of the business, quite understandably, is to make money. They get a commission, 10 to 15%, and they are not as invested as you are in, I would like it to be this certain way that it was written and that you seem to be interested in. And they always will say, just give in. Once you do it, you will always, the only power that you have is the power of no. And meaning it when you say, well, we don't have to do this, because sometimes it's a human nature to say, no, I want to. Like, as soon as you say you don't want to, people sort of want to, if you're lucky. Or somebody has to be a bit of a Napoleon. A nice one, if there is such a thing. But the reason shows that do work is because there is a vision, a singular vision that person sticks to and does not. Now, they'll take a note if it's good, if it means something and it's truly helpful, but they won't. Like the late Gary Shandling. No notes. You can give them to him, but he's, you know what I mean? Like, this is the way it is. But executives, you know, because if they don't give notes, if they don't try and put their hands on it, then why are they there?
Yeah.
Then you lose your parking space and your job, you know? And that's why mainstream TV is as bad as it is. Like, in the States, ABC, NBC, CBS. They are still top-heavy dinosaurs because those people are not letting go of those jobs because of their mortgages and their kids are in private school, what have you. But that's why you keep getting medical shows and legal dramas about, because people love the idea of doctors and cops who care. So you keep having these sort of Grey's Anatomy or Law & Order type franchises on mainstream television because nobody wants to take a chance, or they remake something from another country or remake something that was on before. And because they don't want to, there's nothing more cowardly than a network executive. They do not want to get, they don't want to lose that job. It's a great job, I guess.
But, you know, you would think they realize that all the successful shows are, you know, it's if you look at it, if you step back and look at it, it's obvious that all the successful shows are run by somebody who has a vision and makes the success.
And is allowed to do it, has the power to do
so. It's sort of crazy that
But a lot of shows now are not given a chance to succeed or fail. Now, in the old days, you could be on for a while before you were canceled. And the show would, like Seinfeld, for example, if it finds its audience, the network supports it. That's not the case now because they don't even want to take the time on mainstream television. It's a whole different story outside of the big three or four networks. Yeah. There's so much more going on, and it's proven time and time again there is an audience for great shows. Mad Men, just one example on AMC. Mad Men, one of the best shows I've ever seen. The attention to detail, the specificity. They don't spoon-feed you anything, and that's what I love about a show, when they give you the benefit of the doubt, like the Westworld on HBO, which now I feel they're making up as they go along, but that's a different issue. But in the beginning, it's like, so they think I'm smart enough to follow, or a show called Damages that used to be on. There's many Sopranos. They don't need to give you backstory. They don't need to lay expositional pipe. And now The Many Saints of Newark, if you haven't seen that, the prequel to The Sopranos, so good. It's anything where somebody is not, they're giving you the benefit of the doubt that you're as smart as they are. You know what I mean? And it's really insulting when network people say they won't get it here. Why? Why do you say, so you have no respect for your view. You're saying that your viewers are stupid. Then we're starting from the worst origin point we could start from. So in the long-winded answer to your question, I will duck out. Now, they are welcome to continue with that script and make all the money they want from it if they choose to do so. I'm not going to be part of it. But it'll just take one or two meetings like that, and I'm absolutely done.
Yeah.
Because there's no point in rolling a rock up a hill. We don't need more TV. We really don't. Unless it's going to be good, I feel like.
Sure, I agree. Well, look, we're going to have to stop, unfortunately.
And
mentioning Seinfeld made me realize I haven't even talked about Seinfeld, but we can't talk about it. You'll have to come back on another time.
We're going to stay here. You guys can go, but we're going to stay and keep talking.
We'll talk. Yeah, you can. We might have
with
to
the
go.
Mics.
Yeah,
with the mics.
It's the only way I'll talk to people through a microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the absolute legend, Janeeke Ruffalo. Ladies and gentlemen,
thanks.
We're back tomorrow with Ed Gamble. He's all right. He's all right. Come on.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa from the Edinburgh Fringe with me, Richard Herring, and my fantastic guest, who I know you know who it was. I'm not going to tell you again. You're not stupid. Thank you to Scamp Regard for playing this music. I'm indebted to my technician and friend, Rhys Thomas. I'm also indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and to all the fantastic crew at the ballroom, at the assembly rooms, and everyone at the assembly rooms in Edinburgh. What a fantastic lot of people you are. Thanks for all your help.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.